Hey everyone, I'm Louis Vargas, and you're listening to episode 2 of the Art Scene Podcast. So originally, this was going to be released as the third episode a couple Mondays from now, but I decided to release it a little bit earlier due to the fact that today's guest, Emily Reynolds, has recently curated a new exhibition of work done by Ivan Iannoli at Bassarainer Gallery. And I wanted to get this out there before the show closed on July 10th, and I wanted my listeners to have a chance to hear about it from Emily and then go see it for themselves. So again, the show is currently going until July 10th, and it's at the Bassarainer Gallery at the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco. And yeah, everyone should go see it. All right. So as I mentioned before, my guest today is Emily Reynolds. And Emily is another former classmate of mine at the San Francisco Art Institute and now works at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts as their marketing manager and is one of the co-directors of Bassarainer. Today, we'll talk about the work that she does at both places and what led her down those two career paths and in what she's looking forward to do in the future. So without further ado, here's our conversation. So how are you doing these
very
days?
Very well.
The last time we talked was also at the David Ireland show at San Francisco Institute.
Yeah.
And you're still at the YVCA,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, so you and I both went to school. We were actually both in the same program. I've interviewed Clea. Clea was my first interview, who also was in the program with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one's interesting because I've talked to Clea already about Bassarainer.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about Bassarainer too, because okay. you're also part of it.
We better.
Yeah. And I told Clea was like, I hope this won't be repetitive when you talk to Emily. I said, no, I think I...
You have different opinions.
Right, I think you have different opinions, and I think you have different angles on the story of how this came to be.
Yeah.
And I said, most importantly, I saved certain questions that I think that I saved for other people who are part of Bassarainer. I guess I wanted to start with, like, so I do, because we were in this program together, I did know more about you, that you're from Denver originally.
Mm-hmm. Boulder.
Right,
actually.
Yeah. I like to just generalize.
The football team is named after it's not like the Colorado Rockies, it is the Denver Broncos, so we might as well just call the state Denver.
Sadly, my point of reference for geography in this country is based on sports, cities, and teams.
Much of mine is, too. I think much of, like, everyone's probably is to some extent.
Yeah.
I always get confused about, like, city capitals. I'm like, oh, it's wherever the football team is, right?
Yeah. So what have you been up to lately, YVCA and Bassarainer?
Yeah, between YVCA and Bassarainer, it's very busy. YVCA just relaunched a rebrand that I project managed and in the marketing department. So I have been working really closely with a design firm that came up with the, like, both the visual appearance, but also working on, like, just narrowing down what it is YVCA is trying to do and making sure that that's very clear in all of our, like, communications and marketing and programming. So that's been a huge job. We're also relaunching a new website. And we recently launched a Pay What You Can membership, which is the first one in the country. As far as we can tell, there's lots of museums and stuff that are pay what you can for entrance, but this is a membership for a whole year. You can come to YVCA as much as you want, go to all of our, like, openings and some other, like, really amazing programs for whatever you think it's worth, which is, yeah, just, like, an exciting program to be working on.
Yeah, it's
I feel like a spokesperson.
No. But no, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's something I wanted to mention, because I saw that, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
But, and just so everyone knows, YVCA is the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts.
Yeah, sorry.
It's like, you know, it's fine. It's a... It's not necessarily a museum, kind of is, kind of not.
Yeah, it's funny. I get scolded all the time for calling it a museum because I come from a museum background, and I just am like, oh, well, and I think that my work is geared mainly towards the visual arts side of things, though I do work on the performing arts side, and performing arts, much to my confusion, when I even, like, first came to San Francisco, does not mean performance art. It means, like, performing arts, like dance and theater. And I was confused about that. I was very much in one world.
Caroline Schneeman.
Exactly. It's like Alonzo King Lines Ballet, which, yeah, very different. Yeah. But yeah, so because it's both of those things, and then there's also a film department, we have, like, a really kind of... Everyone calls it the hidden gem of San Francisco for films, which is, like, we're constantly trying to make sure it's not hidden, yeah. But it is a really, it's a nice little theater, and yeah, we have a good film department, so it really is doing more. And then we just started a civic engagement department, and it used to be community engagement, I think that's what they called it, but now we're calling it civic engagement, and really trying to create change. That's kind of like, it's a very activist sort of institution, and yeah, we're not really a museum. We're technically an art center, but we're not really an art center.
Yeah.
We're more than that. We're trying to be more of just like a center.
And you guys are, so YBCA is actually right. So the other thing is I used to intern there. So that was the other common thing we had.
I forgot about that actually for the moment.
I sometimes like to forget about half of that entrance, that 2-year internship I did. But I interned for Betty Sue Hertz, who was also a professor of ours at SFAI. And that was the whole interesting story.
Well, and I started working there. Did you know Betty Sue when you started interning? We hadn't had her as a teacher.
We haven't had her as a teacher, but I knew of her because she used to curate at the SDMA in San Diego, the San Diego Museum of Art. And while I was an undergrad, so a lot of, when I would go on field trips through my art classes.
Yeah, you saw
her work. Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Not her artwork, but her practice.
Right.
Yeah.
And when I graduated, she took the job in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
Coincidentally. Uh-huh. And then through another classmate of ours who was a year above us in the museum studies program, basically she was leaving the internship and gave it to me.
Yeah.
And I had all these meetings with Betty Sue, and Betty Sue was trying to fill me out and see like what kind of person I was.
Oh yeah, she was there. Cause I started as a gallery guide there before we had Betty
Sue. You were
Sue
smart. You got paid
too.
For
I
your
did get paid for my
I
work. Yeah. No, I started from the beginning in a paid position.
Yeah.
Luckily. Yeah. And I was like, the Betty Sue interview was always very intense.
Very intense. I got a lot of the, interestingly enough, I was at the time I was the only male intern she had, and there was a lot of female. Well, in general, the field that I decided to be a part of, I was one of 17, I was the only guy out of 17 people on programs.
Exactly.
It's
crazy how that's. I mean, it is consistent throughout the field until you get into like director roles.
Yes,
and it's like. Again, completely masculine, which bodes well for you in the future.
right. But I think that's unfair too, because especially because a lot of who have become my mentors or have taught me or advised me, most of the time are women.
Yeah.
And so it is very weird for me to see that at the end of the day, it's like a dude is like a director and I'm like, how the hell did this happen? When majority of people who've been teaching me are all women.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. It's weird, but so, yeah, I did that internship, but you were there working, getting paid, and luckily for you, you made the transition easily from like one night you were a gallery guy, the next day you were like now the marketing.
I mean, it took time. I like my whole like thing through grad school, as you probably remember, is I worked everywhere. I worked at every museum.
Yes.
I worked first at the Asian Art Museum, and then I worked at the De Young and the Legion of Honor, all in visitor services because it was like part time, and I just was like, I need money. Plus, it's always just like nice to be practicing or seeing what you're talking about in practice.
Right.
So yeah, I worked in visitor services like all throughout the Bay Area, and then got the job as a gallery guide and was working that concurrently with other museum jobs. And then after we graduated, it was, I definitely had my like at least 4 months of like, freak out, what am I going to do? Oh my God, I need a job. This isn't enough. I need more. I was nannying too.
Yeah.
And then, just like good timing. Someone left. I didn't think I was going to get the job because this was an entry level marketing job and I had like 5 interviews.
Yeah.
I do not understand to this day. We have actually, one of the things that the director of my department has like sort of mandated for the rest of the institution is like, that is ridiculous. People have 2 interviews maximum.
Right.
Even for like huge jobs, you do not need to have 5 interviews.
Right.
So
that's
I just was like this. It took like, I think the whole hiring process there took over 2 months. And I was just like, no, I'm never going to get this job. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. I have the job I have, it was a 3-month process. And it was 2 months between the final interview
before
they told me, and I said, "Oh, this job is still open."
Like, I assumed I was not getting this because it had been far too long. I do not understand what the people are just so scared to hire the wrong person. I guess, but the time is not going to help them.
Right.
Yeah.
So you started out as a marketing assistant there, but because I know you through graduate school, and I know graduate school, you were actually more involved in curating. You really wanted to go the curatorial route. Kind of explain how that even came to be. I know, but the audience doesn't know.
It happened in part just because I needed a job, as you know, too, the curatorial side is so hard to get a job in. I had been a curatorial assistant at University of Colorado before I came to grad school, and I loved curating in grad school, but while we were in grad school, I also just sort of started trying to learn other parts of the museum job world, just so that I would feel like I could, so that I was so I had multiple skills, because there's two curatorial, there's our museum studies program, but then there's also a curatorial program at CCA, and there's just too many curators.
Yeah.
Not too many curators for the city, but too many curators for people to get jobs as curators.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do really design, and I'm kind of a strategic thinker, which helps a lot in marketing. And so, when I got out of school, I was looking for marketing and developing jobs, also because they pay the most.
This is true.
In the museum world, I was like, those will be good. And, I still curate at Boston Rainer, and I occasionally take on other curatorial projects. I'm about to try to find a show to do somewhere else outside of Boston Rainer, which will be interesting.
Yeah.
I just came to this conclusion that someday I'll get back to curating. I have a desire someday to be a director of a small space. YBCA is big. We have the total staff is 500, but the total full-time staff that sits in the office is 80. There's a lot of people. It's a big museum for me. I want to work somewhere that's 10 people, and I'm the director, and I make all the decisions, and I get to curate sometimes too. That's dream job, but someday I'll get there.
Was art always something you wanted to do since you were a kid?
Were
you around it a lot?
I was. So my mom was a curator a little bit, and also worked in, she sort of started in curating actually, and then moved into education departments at museums.
Oh,
yeah, she worked at UCLA at the museum there, maybe before it was the Hammer even, I can't remember. And then she actually worked in San Diego too.
Oh, really?
I can't remember what museum she worked in there
either. I'm going to assume it's SDMA.
Yeah, I think she did. Yeah, I think that is where it was. And so she had done all this museum stuff long before I was born.
Right.
And then, actually she moved back to Colorado to marry my dad and then had me. But throughout my young life, she was a program, special programs coordinator at a library, which frequently involved sort of arts programming. And she curated exhibitions in the library, which is, kind of small time. But she had been an art history major, and all our vacations were only to see museums. I have still to this day been on maybe one beach vacation, and that was with Nando, not with my family. We don't do those.
So I grew up next to a beach in San Diego, but funny enough, similarly, we did not take beach vacations either. My parents were road trip people.
Many road trips. Yeah, it's always to some site of historical or geological significance, or we went to Mexico City long before Mexico City was a place that white people went for vacation, because my mom was like, there's so many museums. Oh my God. It was very boring.
Yeah. So you've been surrounded by a lot then.
It's definitely something I grew up with. Living in Colorado, we weren't, there's the Denver Art Museum, and there's been things that have come after that, but it also was you have to travel if you're invested in it there.
Was your dad the same way?
My dad is definitely an artist or a creative person, but he's not really an artist. Right now he's really into music. He's becoming a DJ, kind of, which is what kind of DJ? Well, he's bought a lot of synthesizers, and Nando says it's not a DJ, but he's like a musician. I don't know. He's like he's always been musically inclined, but he's like now going into this like late in life music thing.
Right. Is he retired?
Yeah, he's retired. But he was actually, he worked for a parks department. So he was like, he started off as like a like lawnmower and street maintenance guy and then worked his way up and eventually was the supervisor of the Boulder County Parks Department, or Boulder City Boulder Parks Department.
Yeah, yeah.
But totally like had a job that was very, that's like blue collar, right? Yeah. That's like labor, right, like on the streets. Right. Yeah. And then sort of, but also just, I mean, his dad was a doctor. He had lived in, he grew up in England for a few years.
Like, oh, wow.
So he kind of had been introduced to a lot of, like, culture early on as well and appreciated it.
Yeah.
So it was like, yeah, it was weird. Yeah, it was a weird household, but it was.
So then, is it safe to assume that since a kid, you've liked the idea of curating? You've always kind of, like, this is like.
No, I guess my mom always wanted me to be a doctor. Of course, I feel like. Your parents always want you to do exactly what you didn't, what they didn't do, right?
Lawyers, like, doctors.
Yeah, my mom was like, we never have enough money. You should definitely be a doctor.
Yeah.
And I knew that I didn't want to be a doctor because I never liked math or science. And it was very clear to me at a young age that I would not be able to like make that work. Ever since I realized I couldn't be a princess and a doctor, I was like, no, I don't think I'm going to be a doctor.
Not happening.
But then I did. I really wanted to be an architect. So I spent, like, I think I like got the idea in middle school into my head that I wanted to be an architect, and I was obsessed with that. And that was absolutely completely true until I was 22. this was not like, I don't know how I was so set on something. I feel like
were you George Costanza wannabe architect?
No,
or were legit?
I went to architecture school that like was a year away from graduating before I was like, I don't want to be an architect. Like, I just think I was like, for some reason, someone must have like taught me that I needed to be very committed to ideas or something. And I feel like I said one time that I needed to be, that I wanted to be an architect, and for some reason was just like not going to let that go.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went to, in high school, I like worked really hard and always just like knew that I was going to apply to, that I wanted to be an architect. In college, I started at Mount Holyoke College and they had an architectural studies program, which I liked that versus a regular architecture program because it was a little more artistic. And I also really wanted to go to a liberal arts school instead of like a state school that had like a 4-year architecture degree because I already somehow knew that I didn't want to design tract houses. And I thought that's all you would do if you went to a state school.
Yeah.
I think my understanding of architecture was not very clear though. Like no one's is. Right. I think a lot of people who think they want to be an architect is like, oh yeah, because I think it'd be fun to like design homes or something.
Right.
And then you start school and you're like, oh wow, it's actually a lot bigger than I thought it was, like this field, but that's awesome. And then it's really great. And then for me, it started to dawn on me that, I studied abroad in Denmark and was like introduced to the like broader field all of a sudden because Mount Holyoke is an all women's school.
Yeah, I was gonna ask it was one of the seven sister schools, or whatever they call
it.
Yeah,
it's an all women's school, and there was like 10 people in the architecture studies program, so I knew them all really well, and they were awesome. You know, like it was a great group of women. And then, but like, it wasn't very competitive. Like we were just all kind of friends. And then I like studied abroad and started to see like, holy shit, this is a cutthroat field. Actually, even during study abroad, which, you know, most people are supposed to like party the whole time. Like it was hard. I pulled more all nighters studying abroad than I ever had in my life. And I was like very confused by that. It was awesome. And I like loved the like studio culture, and I kind of tend to get obsessed with things like that very easily. But I also started to realize that like people don't make money when they like architects don't make money until they're like, until they own their own firm.
Right.
And most architects never own their own firm. And it just like the realities of what it is to be an architect started to become more apparent of, like, I'm going to work with all of these people. Like, literally, there's only three places you can study architecture abroad, so it's, all of those programs are pretty big. So I was like, I will probably work in an office with at least five of the people that I know studying abroad. And they're fine and they're great, but, like, we're all just going to be doing CAD all day, and I don't really even know CAD yet because I went to a school that doesn't really teach, like, architecture that way. And it just, like, started to dawn on me that this was, like, horrible and I didn't want to do it at all.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was taking, well, at Mount Holyoke for the whole time, I'd already always taken art history classes because I was interested in it, and part of their architectural studies program encouraged you to take art history and sculpture classes, especially because there's obvious sort of, like, things that you learn in there that you need to know for the cross-discipline part of architecture. So I had been taking those art history classes, and then I was taking some really good art history classes in Copenhagen where we got to visit galleries and visit museums and talk about, like, very contemporary art in a way that I hadn't really ever experienced contemporary art before. And it just, like, dawned on me that I just needed to maybe study, like, the history of architecture.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I, like, started going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you make the transition from Mount Holyoke to CU?
Oh, this is a great story. Yeah. I'm going to betray all of my, like, besides being very set on being an architect, I was not very set on much else.
Yeah.
So I started at Mount Holyoke, and I went there for three semesters, and I did really love it, but I was, like, so homesick. I was such, like, a Colorado girl, and then New England is very different than Colorado.
Yeah.
Was, like, very shocked by just, like, the culture, the cultural differences. And so after three semesters, I was like, nah, I can't do this anymore. So I transferred to CU, and I went there for a semester, and I hated it. But I was still doing architecture then.
Yeah.
And like, state school and like, the way that CU's architecture program, they didn't even call it architecture. It was environmental design. And the first
very
year.
Very CU of them.
Yeah. And the first year was just, like, really horrible. I just, like, hated the classes I was in. And so that's when I had wanted to do study abroad throughout the whole thing. My mom had studied abroad in Vienna, and sort of, like, it was always clear to me that studying abroad was something that I wanted to do, and I really wanted to do it for a whole year, not just a semester. So after that one semester at CU, was like, okay, well, I'm going to go abroad next year, and then I'll figure everything else out after that. So I went abroad. It was amazing. Copenhagen was, like, a life-changing place, and I, like, met my, like, best friend there, and, like, everything was great. But then, yeah, when I came back from Copenhagen, I actually decided to go back to Mount Holyoke for a semester because I thought I would be done faster since I'd already, like, done a lot of work there. But that was not the case, and they were going to make me stay for a whole extra year after all of my, like, friends had graduated, and I was like, no. And Mount Holyoke is also quite expensive.
Yeah.
And so then I went back to CU and spent another three semesters there, and didn't even pay as much as I would in one semester.
And does she get, like, a discount too? Because you're
in state. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I, like, yeah, like, I barely paid anything at CU, and it was fantastic. Once I transferred into the art history program in the art visual arts department, it was like, oh, these are my people.
Right.
Like, I see now. I also think that I was, like, a little, like, young when I started college. I wasn't actually young, but I just was immature, and I, like, didn't know how to, like, get the most out of a, like, relationship with a professor or anything like that. And so Copenhagen sort of enabled me to do that just because the professors were a little more friendly or so, or maybe it was just, like, at Mount Holyoke, every girl who went in there was, like, so desperate to, like, get that teacher attention that I was, like, turned off by it. And then being at CU where no one was trying to, I was like, oh, I'll be the one that talks to the professor now.
Well, it sounds like the experience in Copenhagen was kind of a sink or swim kind of thing, yeah, too. So kind of like you probably were still in that sink or swim.
Yeah, exactly.
Like mentality when you went to see you, which yeah, is a lot different what it was the first time you went back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, then I like started, I took a bunch of architectural history classes with Bob Nauman, who is a genius, and I just adored him. And I had great advisors, and I like ended up graduating with honors. And yeah, just had a great time.
The good old days.
Yeah, exactly.
Got honors. I was
I know. Ass. All of a sudden, yeah, I was like, I had been like sort of like at Mount Holyoke, I'd been like, my grades were really good. I like pretty much got all A's, but I was like definitely like a mediocre student in that I like wasn't trying that hard.
Right.
And then at CU, I had to actually try, and that's better for me. Yeah. Like, I need to have someone be like, no, you have to, you're not going to just get an A. You have to like work. And then I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, so that was better.
So now, so you're done at CU, you got your degree. Was there any moment of like did you go directly into SFAI? Was there like a year or was
There was only a semester. What happened was during my last semester at CU, interned at the CU Art Museum as part of a museum studies class, actually, like my first museum studies class. So in that time I started interning at CU, and the director, Lisa Tamaris Becker, seemed to really like me pretty quickly. She recognized that I was like very smart. I was, working on my honors thesis, which was about institutional critique. And she had like done a lot of research on Merle Lauterman Euclid, who was like a huge case study in my thesis. And so we sort of bonded about that. And, yeah, she really liked me. And so I graduated, in the, like winter semester, and her curatorial assistant was leaving. And so she asked me to come on and be the curatorial assistant.
That's cool.
So I, yeah. And it was like, usually she only asked grad students to do that. I was the first undergrad that she ever asked. And yeah, it was just like so exciting that I was like, of course I'll do that.
Yeah.
But I guess I must have already been applying to grad schools because I wouldn't have been able to get in time, right?
Right,
so yeah, yeah, so I must have like intended to go straight to grad school.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So how was that experience as a curatorial? I mean, because when I remember you telling me that when we were in school together,
yeah,
and I was like, this is awesome because that means you like, you get it. You had a taste of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I had worked at the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art on and off throughout. I think I started my first summer home from college from Mount Holyoke. So I had like been working in museums too, since, yeah, pretty much when I was like 19, I think. Actually, no, even before then, when I was in high school, I had like been an intern for their like summer kids camp and stuff too.
Yeah.
So I was like already part of the museum kind of,
yeah,
air, like the museums in Boulder, which is too.
Why did they put the interns in the kids' camps?
Oh, yeah. That, well, especially, first, I was, like, yeah, so young. Like, yeah. I couldn't do anything else, I don't think.
I remember, like, one of my first internships was at a contemporary art museum for children in San Diego called the New Children's Museum. And that's where they put me with,
yeah,
a bunch of kids. And it was so funny to me because I was just like, what every internship I do is like, I'm dealing with kids.
Start with kids, yeah.
I have
exactly
to be like 21 before they take me seriously.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that was, yeah, that's pretty much the case. Yeah, so I'd been working at the Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art. And then, so I had already like had a little bit of experience too. It was like visitor services, but still it was like, I knew the right people basically.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, it was awesome. Like I immediately started, we like the biggest project that we had during that time, besides like regular exhibitions and stuff, was, it was a crazy moment where she was trying to get, 6 different publications out the door that were all in various states of completion. And so I kind of had to take on like the project of getting those done, like proofreading all of them, going through them over and over again, sending them to anyone else who needed to proofread them. And yeah, I was like, I'm thinking back, it's crazy that I had to do that in like 6 months. Yeah. We got 6 catalogs out the door published. A couple of them were delivered after I like finished working, but all of them done under my purview, which was insane.
Yeah.
And we put on a couple exhibitions. They were really cool. I worked on that. They had like a big fundraising gala during the time that I was there that I worked on. It was like, and that's a really small museum. There's the director, and there's a communications manager, and then two registrars and like some, and a preparator, but I think that's the entire staff. It's like 5 or 6 people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And then when we're at SFAI, again, you're still set. I want to curate. I want to do something.
Yeah. Like, well, when I applied to grad schools, I applied to museum studies, like strict museum studies programs. And I applied to a couple exhibition design programs because I still sort of saw myself as someone who was specializing in architecture. And a lot of my like institutional critique research had actually been on exhibition design and architecture, which I then carried over into my grad school stuff too. But yeah, I always kind of like was very interested in the marriage of architecture and museums. And so I was like thinking maybe I was going to do exhibition design. And I think that it wasn't kind of until I started working at a small museum that I realized like, that's actually just a curator at most places. Yeah. Like you should probably just like take on all of those responsibilities instead of just trying to do the design of the exhibition,
right.
Unless you want to work at like a science museum or something, which was like not my,
which I do, by the way, let me tell you, it's annoying.
Which was not my desire. I was like, no, I see myself as like in a probably contemporary arts institution. So they don't really do exhibition design there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was like, okay, then I guess I just want to be a curator, but I knew I didn't want to apply to curatorial studies programs because I didn't think you'd get a job if you had that. So I was like, yeah, museum studies is good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did want to, be a curator and really, like I wanted to be a curator who really thought about like design and architecture.
Right.
Without curating design and architecture necessarily.
Yeah. 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 Did you find that, what was it at SFAI that you got out of that now carries on because as a marketing assistant at YBCA and then now like one of the co-directors of your own art gallery?
Yeah. It's interesting because there's like definitely just like obvious skills. Like we had to do, we put on exhibitions all the time that then we had to be the marketer of, and I helped other people with marketing their exhibitions when we did our big like collaborative project at the end of the time.
Right.
I was in charge of the marketing for that. So I like put just that stuff into practice, and I took a class with Kevin Conzi that was, we were in that
I
one,
was
right?
In that
yeah.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which wasn't super helpful, but like I got a good understanding of like what marketing questions that come up in marketing.
Well, it's interesting that that's what you got of it, which is what you do now.
Yeah.
Because that was the only class where I learned stuff that I now apply to what I do now too.
Exactly.
But it's completely different from marketing. Mine was museum policy, like, the management part of it. But it's interesting. Like I talking to Clea about this too, that was kind of my experience with SFAI was, we would take a class, but each of us got something out of it that was very particular to us.
Yeah.
Well, what about marketing what drew you to that? That what made you in all those different projects want to do the marketing?
I think that it was first like, well, it was just like designing the show cards kind of. Like I always because I had done architecture, I was like pretty good at using like Creative Suite.
Right.
And I was like, oh, and because I'd done all those publications actually, and I'd worked at CU on a lot of marketing materials too, I had gotten kind of interested in how museums present shows before anyone's even seen them, right? Like what a show card looks like and how museums are kind of using graphic design today. University of Colorado had been working with a kind of cutting edge for Colorado design firm.
Yeah.
That then a bunch of other museums started using because they liked what we were putting out. And so I thought that was kind of interesting that there's like how museums sort of engage with design and graphic design to make themselves feel like appear to be contemporary.
Right.
So that was something I was interested in. And then personally, I also was like, oh, for me, it's fun to take over doing some marketing stuff because then I get to like design the show card and I get to kind of think about how like the identity of the exhibition is represented graphically before anyone sees any work. And so that was kind of the like basis of why I started doing it in grad school.
So now you're working at YBCA. I think you did start working there while I was the last months of my internship.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So Bass and Rainer. So you're at YBCA. Bass and Rainer is in the process of being set up.
Yeah, I think Clea came to me with that idea, like, before I'd actually even started the job. Like, I think we were kind of, I think both of them sort of started at the same time.
Yeah, her and Marielle, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what made you want to be a part of it? Like, when they pitch it to you, they're like, hey, by the way, we want to get this space. This is what we want to do. What drew you to that?
Yeah.
To want to do it?
Well, Clea and I had joked forever about how we would be really good at, like, directing a museum together as a team, because the skills that she has are almost opposite of the skills that I have. Like, she is good at certain things that I'm not good at, and I'm really good at things that she's not good at.
Yeah.
So we had always kind of like joked about how we'd be really good at that. And we had worked so many times on things together in grad school. We'd done like her Google stuff. I like helped a lot with, and I did all the like design and identity for that stuff. I always sat in on install for her shows. She usually sat in on install for my shows. We just like always were working back and forth. And then we'd like done that book room thing together. Like, we just had worked a lot together. And so, I was like super excited that we were going to actually have an opportunity to put into play, like to actually do the stuff that we had been talking about doing. And then I also, was going through that moment of like, okay, so we graduated from school. I have now secured a job that is like going to pay my rent and do the things that I like absolutely need to do. And it's not necessarily exactly what I went to school for, but I'm very happy with it. And I think that I will succeed there and be excited to do it, which is perfect. But I still wanted a creative outlet and a place to curate. And I know like you can always curate independently. You can always be pitching shows to people and stuff. But it's so much nicer not to have to find space.
Yeah.
It's so much easier to just be like, oh, it's my space. I do that there. So, yeah, it was like, okay, well, here's this opportunity for me to kind of guaranteed get to do probably like 2 to 3 shows a year. And then, and then I can do whatever else I want on the side.
Yeah.
So that was like, it was perfect. It was exactly what I was like looking for. Of course, you have to pay into it because at that point we were completely just starting. But it was also exciting for me to think about how we could start this gallery or whatever it was. Because at that point we weren't even like sure. We were like, is it going to be a nonprofit? Is it going to be a for-profit? Like, what kind of artists are we going to show? And I was like, we need to have like a mission statement, and we need to be really like clear with what we're doing, even if it's not a traditional gallery or a traditional traditional nonprofit space. I just want us to be clear what we're doing so that when we don't do things, we can say why we're not doing them. The like putting the structure in place kind of was fun just after having thought of all the like things that museums put into place and other arts organizations being like, we're going to do this now. We're going to actually like take all that stuff we've been studying and put it into practice.
Yeah. And, what do you see the future for Bass and Rainer?
I think that we are doing super well right now as a commercial gallery, which is really odd for me because I never, ever, ever thought I would work in a gallery. I honestly never thought that. I was so opposed to, not opposed to galleries in that I like don't think they should exist, but I just was like, I'm such a nonprofit person and I like desperately want artists to get paid for their labor and stuff. And I'm still have like issues with art being commercial, but I also feel like, okay, so artists can get paid for their labor at museums, but a lot of artists also make work that they can sell as objects. So why don't I help them? And we've kind of set up Boston Rainer in a way that makes it so that we can do both. Like, for the show that I just curated, Hunker Down, the first one, a Minnesota Street Project, we knew very well that much of that work would not sell. That wasn't really the point of it, and it's awesome to work with those guys because we can kind of, like, talk strategically about, like, okay, we know that this show is just sort of not about selling work. It's about making sure that people come back to the space, right? So let's do something really cool and really interesting and that will, like, photograph really well and that will really attract press. And that's what we want to do for the first show because that's how people will start to remember us. And then they'll come back for the second show. And if we have stuff that's a little more commercially viable in that you can actually put it on your wall, that's great. Then that's perfect. We've done worse what we were trying to do.
Yeah. And so each of you are so different. Like, you all have different backgrounds. Like, Clea and you have museum studies background, but Clea, even after talking to Clea, and you mentioned it even right now, never really had a real interest in galleries. It was always, the goal was to work in a museum.
Yeah, exactly.
Marielle and Chris were both MFA students. They're both artists. But Chris is more of a teacher now, more these days.
Yeah, well, and I always forget that Chris didn't do art before. He did art history.
Right.
And then kind of, like, I'm interested. I hope you interview him.
Oh, I find out it, yeah.
I'm very interested. I don't know exactly why he decided to go to art school. I'd be interested in hearing that.
Yeah, I think I went to go visit your gallery over at Minnesota Street Project, and that got brought up a little bit in the conversation where he dropped a little hint about his background, about how he didn't really do photography even when he was younger.
Yeah,
and
he
was
just always had a camera and took photos. He started assisting photographers. We'll leave this for conversation.
Yeah, the reason why I mention that is because each of you are so different, but you all are co-directors. You all run this. How does that dynamic work when you guys are doing shows? Because Clea had mentioned you guys take turns for the most part curating a show.
Yeah. So it works how we try to do it, and we're not always perfect at this because of also just, like, timing, and, like, sometimes you just need to lock a thing down. But the, like, intention is that we each are able to sort of pitch ideas and be like, oh, I really want to work with maybe this artist and this artist, and the show is kind of about this. And then we bring it to the group like that, and then we have the opportunity to say, like, I know, you know, like, everyone has the opportunity to say, why do you want to work with that artist? Like, sometimes there's some people who we've just been like, no, we're not going to do that. We don't want to work with them. Thanks for bringing it, but
sorry, that's
try
awful.
Again. Yeah, exactly. Try again. So that happens sometimes, or it's just like, that sounds great, but there's like too many barriers between, like, getting that work or something like that. So there's, like, a moment of kind of, like, bringing it before everyone and everyone having a chance to talk about any concerns they have or if they just love it or, like, how on board are they. We also, we all do studio visits all the time. And so, like, when I'm interested in actually working with an artist, I kind of will push them really hard to try to do a studio visit with me, or at least one of them, so that I feel like someone else has a good idea of, like, why I'm interested in this artist. And then we kind of pitch the shows, and then usually, like, so far, everybody's kind of, like, gotten the show that they wanted, even if it's been a little bit, like, altered because of practical reasons or because we're like, nah, that's not a great fit. You should look at a different artist.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how, and then we have, like, we've recently re-sat down to really, like, go through, like, roles after that, like, what are we expecting the curator to do? But then, because we all have other jobs, we have to be, like, really mindful of, like, the curator can do so much, but they can't do everything.
Yeah.
So there's four of us, we have to split a lot of the things off. Like, Grunder will take care of, like, how we're gonna ship stuff, how we're gonna get stuff. Clea, like, manages the installation, and how things are getting installed. So, like, once an artist kind of gets brought on board, then they start having to talk to all of us, which is fun.
Yeah. So then, like, so that's interesting. So, like, let's say Clea's doing, it's her show, right? Mm-hmm. She's curating the show. Those roles still kind of are constant, where she handles the installation. Chris does, like, a lot of the shipping.
Yeah. So I'll still do the marketing.
Right.
Yeah. And I kind of take the first pass on statements. Well, usually the curator takes the first pass on a statement, but then I'll go through and, like, edit it pretty heavily, depending, try to make it actually be more enticing to a viewer.
And Marielle.
And then also press release, and Marielle is the bookkeeper, so she will work on, like, okay, is this feasible from a, like, standpoint of, you know, we're currently trying to pay our rent with how much art we sell. So, it's like, what, like, you know, we can't sell $100 paintings because we can't make our rent with a $100 painting.
Right.
So, yeah, she kind of can look at the feasibility of, like, pricing and making sure we're pricing things in the right place. And, yeah.
That's a good system. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed. When I thought about your guys' gallery, I thought of the Ferris Gallery, like, in L.A. back in the day, which is where Walter Hopps and Ed Kienholz started. And it was kind of the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Walter Hopps was recently out of graduate school. I think he was still in graduate school, but he dropped out of it or something. But he was wanted to start something, wanted to curate. And then Ed Kienholz was an artist that wanted to just show art for artists by artists kind of mentality. It was a disaster. I mean, historically, if you read about it, it's a disaster, but a lot of it had to do with that, where they didn't understand the roles, they couldn't establish what roles they were going to be.
It's hard. Yeah. It is really hard, and it's, I mean, like, we're small enough that we all share one email address, right?
Yeah.
Which is difficult, just, like, but it's also really difficult to convince people that, like, even though we're a really small gallery, for these things, you should email this person. So we share one email address, which can be difficult, but also it's good because we all have kind of a tab on what's going on at all times. If someone is lagging for whatever reason, just because, like, we're busy beyond the gallery, someone else can step in if they need to. But it is, it's that, like, that's one of the things that we have to keep just, like, going back to, is this, like, everyone's roles and responsibilities and making sure they're super clear so that we don't have those moments of, like, everyone trying to do everything.
Right.
Yeah.
I asked Clea this, and I plan on asking every single one of you. 10 years from now, where you see it, do you still hopefully see it kicking, or?
It's, like, so interesting. We were recently interviewed for the Chronicle, and they have just interviewed Evergold. And, Andrew started that it was almost like an identical situation. Like, he started it with three other people from SFAI, and the other three have fallen off through various things. I, like, wouldn't be surprised if that happens, just because, like, I personally don't think I'll stay in the Bay Area for 10 years.
Yeah.
Maybe I will, but I'm surprised I'm still here, to be honest.
Yeah, so. I agree as well.
So it's like, but I feel like it will exist. I feel like that, like, Clea and Grunder are so committed to being here that, like, probably someone will be here running it. I don't know who it'll be. It might not be any of us. Maybe we'll have completely given it over to someone, but it seems like it's likely that it'll still exist.
Well, it's interesting because Clea mentioned to me about she still thinking about getting her PhD.
Was one.
And, you obviously still want to get into a major museum.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, I anticipate that at some point I won't have time to, like, be running a gallery on the side.
Yeah.
But that could be years from now.
Yeah. I mean,
I'll just can surprise myself and always do that. I recently had to, like, sit down with my boss, and she was like, "What are you doing? Like, why are you doing this?" Like, YBCA is so incredible because they do. I mean, so many people that work there do something else too. Like, and it's very, like, open to that.
Yeah.
And they let me, like, work from the gallery on Fridays, which is amazing. But, just out of, like, I think out of, like, more of, like, career pathing for me, she was like, "Why are you doing it? Like, what is the point of that?"
Right. Are you leaving me to
how are you more committed to that than this? But I think she just wanted to be like, are you trying to, like, be, like, do you want to move forward at YBCA? Are you trying to just, like, do that full time? And it's like, no, I like doing the gallery so much, but I do not want to do it full time.
Right.
And honestly, we don't need four people to run a gallery, run this size of a gallery.
No, not at all.
And we couldn't afford.
No. And I think it came out of necessity, I think, at the beginning, where we need the only way this is going to work if we split the rent.
Yeah,
the ways.
Exactly.
And the rising rent problem.
Yeah,
exactly. In San Francisco. It's just... Yeah, I mean, do you see, because now that you're super involved in marketing at YBCA, mm-hmm. Do you see yourself going that route still when you move in within the museum business?
I don't know. Like, I don't think that I would.
Or, like, are you hoping the curatorial experience from Bass and Rainer and the combination of that will hopefully allow you to make lateral moves?
Yeah, I think that probably not inside of YBCA. Right. I think I'm pretty committed to staying in marketing at YBCA. But I think that someday I might be able to make kind of a lateral move into a smaller place.
Yeah.
You know, at a lot of places, communications and development are together. And yeah. I think I could probably do that.
Yeah.
Or some, you know, if it's really small, they might just like have a program director or something, which does all of it. And
I came to that realization within the last 3 weeks where I was like, I don't think I'm going to be a collection manager or registrar at this rate.
Yeah.
I keep applying to jobs and not getting them. But in the meantime, I keep accumulating these experiences that are still important to the museum business.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think I just made, my boss had asked me basically, what do you want here? And I said, well, I definitely don't want to work at a science museum forever, but I don't mind this place, but I think development. And it was like having to realize I have to pick something that's transferable anywhere, but that I'm going to be happy with doing.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of interesting because for me, some days I'm like, oh my God, I love Mark. Like some days I love it. And then other days I do like it a lot. Like, I don't think I would be upset if I ended up being like a director of marketing.
Right.
That would be a great job.
Yeah.
And it would just have been like, it just sort of depends on my series of choices over the next 10 to 15 years. So.
And I've mentioned this before, but I think the one of the greatest assets of having someone like you in a marketing position is that you get it. You get museums, you get the business behind it, you get the mentality in the art community of how they see museums, which I think is still a problem in marketing departments. At museums. They still hire the fresh out of college marketing.
Yeah,
assistant.
Marketing people. Yeah. And we have some of those, and it's really interesting. We have some of those at our, at our museum. But it's interesting. And actually, the chief of marketing, who is just amazing, but she worked at Leo Burnett, which is a huge ad firm that's where she started her career. And she worked in private ad firms for a long time and then eventually started working at the MCA Chicago.
Wow.
So she really like has a background in advertising, and it's fun to learn from her because I obviously don't and don't have anything near it, but it's like I am an asset on the team because, you know, they'll talk about an artist and kind of be like, oh, is that a big deal? And I'm like, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Or, no, they're not a big deal. Don't.
Yeah.
You should definitely say the like title of the program instead of the name of the artist first, because they're not. But and it's also, and also just like how museums work. And like we are, you know, I get scolded a lot for like, well, we're not a typical museum. But that's when I have to be like, no, exactly, we're not. And that's why we need to like talk about this pay what you can membership in an exciting way, because this is like something that museums don't do, and we're not a museum, but like we're trying to do this thing that museums should be doing. You know, like we have to like figure out how to stake ourselves against museums, and you can't you have to like know what museums do to also be able to. And then there's also just like things like best practices that I'm like, oh, you know, we should be doing this because museums do it, and we don't want to be worse than them. We want to be better than them.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. And the YBCA to me is very interesting with Deborah as the director, because she was not the director when I first interned there.
Yeah. Ken Forster was. Yeah. Deborah started at the exact same time as I started gallery guiding.
Yeah.
So I never knew the pre-Deborah YBCA.
It was very. It was a lot more museum focused, I think.
Yeah.
And, that they wanted to be like a museum. And then Deborah came in, and I think she kind of changed it. I think revolutionized what the role of an art center is
in
the city.
What's kind of crazy is like, it's one of the things where I'm like, sometimes I consider like, oh, maybe I should look for other jobs, but the stuff that's happening at YBCA is going to make me much, much like a better asset.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
Like I'm going to be able to work through this museum that's like, or not a museum, this art center that's changing the way that like museums and art centers work. And that's like incredibly important. So, got to stick with it.
So you mentioned you don't know if you're going to even be in the Bay Area in the next 10, like,
yeah.
in 10 years from
yeah.
now,
yeah.
where do you would like to be, or where do you see yourself? Like, do you end up going back to Colorado?
This is, like, something that Nando and I obviously talk a right. lot about.
I am in a relationship, and it's a constant conversation.
If I had to move somewhere right now, I'd move to LA, for sure. I would just move straight to LA, and I would be totally happy. The reason we don't do that now is because San Francisco is going through something right now, as I'm sure you can kind of tell, and it's the things that I'm doing right now and the things that Nando are doing are just, like, seem really important. It's a dumb time to leave.
Yeah.
We've kind of been saying that since graduating, like, oh, it would be okay to leave, but, like, what's the point of having gone to school here if you're just going to, like, sever all of those connections before you've, like, been able to make anything of them? And I think we're now, like, in the process of really making things of our connections and just our community that we graduated with, as well as, like, the people that we have met since then and the things we've started to do. But we're also trying to, like, actively put down roots, or not roots, but feelers in LA and trying to expand our community. Just because also it makes sense. Like, we're two West Coast cities. We're not that far away. We, like, should be cross-pollinating more. And it would be good for San Francisco to get some of the, like...
Don't tell that to any other Southern California. So they'd be like, excuse me? Cross-pollinate? Never. No. You know?
Well, it's funny of how we've had, in the last, like, few months, a bunch of the people that we've met down there have been coming up here. And, like, this new magazine, Carla, Contemporary Art Review LA, is really good. Started by the Zappas, Lindsay Zappas, and then her husband actually is a sculptor, John Zane Zappas. And Lindsay's going to have a show at City Limits this summer. And then this other LA gallery, Vacancy, is having a show at City Limits. And so there's, like, some stuff kind of, like, people are interested in what's going on up here. Yeah. There's, like, eyes up here,
you're like,
which is not happening.
Well, and you're the fifth person who's told me. So I grew up in San Diego. San Diegans hate LA.
Yeah.
They hate it with the they hate the city. They hate the drive, the traffic. They hate the people.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. You're raised to, like, ugh, LA, right? Sports-wise, you name it. But interestingly enough, LA in the last 5-6 years is changing itself. Like, the art scene is getting better.
Mm-hmm.
The neighborhoods are a lot better than they were even when I was growing up. So, like, the stigma of LA that motivated the hatred of LA for a lot of San Diegans is now disappearing.
Yeah.
And it's changing. And so everyone's telling me they want to move to LA. Where 4 years ago, everyone was telling me they wanted to move to San Francisco. Now the conversation has changed to LA.
Yeah, exactly.
And even Steph and I, who love San Diego, we do have plans just like you. Like, 10 years from now, we do not see us being in San Francisco. We would like to go back to San Diego, but we just started exploring, like, Austin's not bad. LA is actually not that bad either.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, we do want to stay in California in some way. There's a lot of good things happening in LA where it just makes sense to move there.
Yeah.
And, but you're right about the, I think, first establishing the connections here, that network. And,
And we'll see. I mean, it's, like I said, it's crazy to me that I'm still here. I'm surprised. And so maybe we'll get to 10 years and I'll be like, oh my God, I'm still here. How did this happen? But, that's the other thing is, like, we run through lists of cities and, like, you know, there's that sort of a dream of someday, like, maybe Nando will be able to just make work, right?
Okay.
Like, won't need to have another job. And then maybe we would want to move somewhere like Colorado or somewhere where we could have, like, he could have a big studio somewhere and I can, like, run a small museum, you know? Like, that's totally plausible.
Right.
But right now it seems really important to stay somewhere that's relevant because both of us need to be, we need to look at work all the time. We need to look at good work.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that we had been missing here, but that seems to be, like, starting.
Yeah.
But we try to go to LA every, like, 6 weeks or so. And we try to go to New York once or twice a year to make sure that we're just seeing stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's because you have to.
Yeah. No, yeah. And to keep current, I think, I just started doing that myself where I realized, like, everything I do is California. Why am I not listening to podcasts out of New York?
Yeah.
Why am I not? And now I'm like, than ever before, Steph laughs about it, but, like, I'm more in tune to what's going on in musicals and art and, like, New York. I'm more in tune of what's going on in LA and mm-hmm. artwork in terms of artwork. And it's, and 5 years ago, I could care less. And,
yeah.
But I'm having to realize that because for the same reason that you just said, like, I think, I don't know why it doesn't happen, but it needs to happen. There needs to be this cross-pollination.
Yeah.
Because I think that's, for the future, what's going to create better art, better
exactly.
music, better
yeah.
draw, like better like theater. I mean, having several influences
mm-hmm.
cross-pollinate.
Yeah, it's like how you move forward, or like,
yeah.
I don't know, things,
right.
Now I'm going to get a little theoretical, but I like, I'm very interested in ideas of regionalism all the time. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, I feel like we have a pretty strong identity in San Francisco. We don't need to worry about, like, it getting messed up by seeing other work.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So we're almost out of time, but the one thing I wanted to ask you was, I guess, you have anything coming up? Like, what is there, what do you got coming up, Boston Rainer or or YBCA rap?
So the next really exciting show we have at Boston Rainer is Ivan Unoli, who is loosely a photographer, but not really. And I just adore his work. He's our first solo show that we're doing at Boston Rainer, and that's kind of been a big sticking point, is I keep arguing that we should do more solo shows, and
yeah.
no one else wants to, because it's less fun curatorially, but I think solo shows can be just as fun.
Yeah.
So that's coming up. Then we have a book show, and then I'm really excited about a show we're doing with Christine Udy, who's local, and Leah Bieferman, who's a photographer based in New York, who is awesome. I'm so excited for that. And then at YBCA, we are doing a Tom Sachs show, which is going to be mind-blowing.
Wow.
Tom Sachs does these crazy bricolage sculptures, and he's, like, staging a trip, a space, it's his third space program, but it's to Europa,
yeah.
the icy moon Jupiter, which is actually where NASA is currently planning a mission to. It's just going to be crazy, so.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
mm-hmm.
thanks for coming on. I wanted to talk to you more about sports, but that, I'm going to save that for a different podcast.
Okay, sounds
you
good.
Being you are a hardcore Denver fan.
Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Me being a San Diego fan, we share very similar divisions.
Exactly. Well, you know, when we play in San Diego, they say that we're just playing at home.
It's so sad. I mean, so sad. But it's the cross that I bear.
Yeah.
San Diego fan. All right. Well, thanks.
All right.
All right, everyone, that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to Emily and learning more about what she does. I definitely plan on having her back sometime soon to catch up, maybe even do a little sports talk with her since she's a big Denver football fan, and I'm a huge Charger fan, and we're technically supposed to be rivals. But be sure to check out the new Ivan Unoli exhibition she curated at Boston Rainer Gallery, which is located at the Minnesota Street Project in San Francisco. For more information on past, present, and future shows, go to bastonrainer.com, and also be sure to follow the YBCA, where she also works, on Twitter and Instagram at YBCA to get updates on events and performances. And lastly, before I sign off, I want to take the time to thank two people who have helped me get this podcast up and running. First, I want to thank my friend Nikki Nolan, who not only helped me set up the podcast website and manage it, but has also created the logo for me. So thanks, Nikki. And second, I want to thank Brian Adler, who has had a hand in the production side of the podcast. I wouldn't be able to have each episode edited and ready to go each week if it weren't for him. Okay, till next time.